Welcome to the London Walks podcast.
This episode,
presented by Andy Hallett and Adam Scott Goulding.
Okay, welcome to our next podcast. We are in spooky Spitalfields. It's Adam here, and I'm waiting for my colleague, Andy. There he is there, my goodness me. Jumping out of the shadows, yes.
We haven't worked that out before, have we?
No, it was entirely spontaneous. Yes, welcome Andy, how are you doing?
Good, yeah, just finished the Jack the Ripper walk.
Very good, I've also finished the Jack the Ripper walk this evening. I was in the company of the general public there.
Yeah.
And yes, a very busy Thursday night.
Yeah, looking forward to Halloween.
Yes, I was just saying there, we're in spooky Spitalfields by way of an introduction to our new Ghosts podcast.
Festival of the Dead coming up.
Festival of the Dead coming up.
31st of October, that time when the boundaries of this life and the other life become transparent, Adam.
It says here, yes. No, it's a very, very busy time of year for us because the ghost walks are, of course, very, very popular. And we get dressed up.
Why do we dress up? We dress up because we are hiding, aren't we? We're hiding from, you know, evil ancestors coming back. We light fires to protect ourselves, or we
try to look like them to disguise ourselves. Is that the idea?
Yeah, the traditions. And, amid all the fun and games and the hilarity, we're doing something, I think, essentially quite pagan. Yeah. Something very fearful.
Well, we're not dancing around naked.
Well, you may not be dancing around naked, but you haven't been on my Ghosts of the Old City walk. Yeah, I think the idea of Halloween being a busy time with lots of kids come on the walks at Halloween, the ghost walks. Four of them, I think we do.
I think we do. Four walks, different walks, but hundreds of people turn up, don't they? It's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah. A carnival atmosphere. The odd thing I was thinking that, I mean, we've just finished doing Jack the Ripper walks, and there's a perception problem there in that, or a perception issue, in so much as people lump the Jack the Ripper tour in with the ghost walks as a sort of general horror thing. I spoke to a very nice woman a few years ago now on the Jack the Ripper tour. She was visiting from North America, and she said that she enjoyed the Jack the Ripper tour here very much. She'd also been on the Jack the Ripper tour in York and in Edinburgh, she told me. So she seemed to think that, you know, Jack the Ripper was like a brand name or a company that ran spooky tours. And she was very nice, very friendly, but it's obviously a misconception there. And I think there is the idea that the Jack the Ripper case is just another horror story, which obviously there's much more to it than that.
Yeah. I mean, someone asked me a couple of days ago, if they know his name is Jack the Ripper, why don't they arrest him?
Why don't we just go and get him? Excuse
Ripper
me,
J.
Are you Mr. Ripper? You're under arrest.
It was a nickname.
Indeed, yes. I think, it seems to be very popular at this time of year as well, with Halloween coming up. But I think that's not entirely correct, I don't think, to demean the people in the story, the women in the story, the victims of this case, by passing it off as Halloween thrills and spills.
Yeah, it's a historical walk, isn't it?
I think so, and, you know, it provides horror from every conceivable angle as well. I mean, the murders, the poverty, the social history. It's horror from top to bottom. I don't think we need to dress up like, you know, Victorian policemen or wear Ulsterman capes. And turn it into a pantomime.
I mean, the canvas for it is the appalling poverty in East End, wasn't it? 55% of people dead before the age of five. It's incredible. So life expectancy no more than 30. I mean, I always say that. I think that's crazy, isn't it? That's incredible, isn't it?
Absolutely. And so this is a horror story of a different stripe.
Yeah.
Certainly. An entirely different kettle of fish from our ghost.
Where do you stand on ghosts now? This is a year on from last year. Wow. Now, last year you just said you kept an open mind, and that was it, Adam.
Well, what's the value of life without a bit of mystery, I think is what I said.
I'm being turned here. I'm beginning to have that gift, I think, that delicate sensibility. Just merely touching a particular building will give me a mild psychic shock these days. I'm
goodness me. This is a revelation. Well, I don't know, because I mean, we do get a lot of people on the ghost walks who truly believe in ghosts. And that's how I start my Ghost of the Old City walk. How many of you actually believe in ghosts? And, you know, many people actually do. And who am I to shoot down people's beliefs in flames? Am I Richard Dawkins? No, I am not. No,
well, we can use them as a ghostly thermometer throughout the walk, can't we?
Quite so.
If they feel any energies or anything like that, they can not to tap us on the back. But like I said, it would frighten us, scare us. But we get the kind of picture, don't we?
Absolutely, yeah.
Looking forward to it. So, yes. So we've got a few things to talk about, haven't we? We've got a few things to record. Looking forward to it. It's going to be a good one.
Yes, and we're going to be on the green as well on the 31st of October.
Let's get out of here before we see any more hauntings. This way.
So I'm here with Dorothy, one of my walkers. We've just done the Haunted London Walk, and we're just about finished at Monument. And Dorothy's got a great story for me about Banshee.
Ireland, land of legends and tall stories and so on. I was driving home from work one night. It would have been about 8:30. It was dark. It was winter time. Quite a calm night. A banshee, of course, is a spirit that a female spirit that wanders Ireland. They're reputed to be very small with long grey hair. And so I was driving along, coming up to a roundabout, it was quite well lit, and I saw what I thought was, first of all, I thought was a white cat, about 18 inches as I got closer, and I thought to myself, it's a monkey, and I don't know why I thought it was a monkey, but it was stroking its face like this. It was strange enough for me to want to go back round the roundabout and come back and see it again, but something made me not do it, and I went on home and was telling the girls in work about it the next day, and one of the girls said, "You saw a banshee." And I said, "Well, what does that mean?" Because they are supposed to be portent to death. So if the banshee is said to sit, and the wailing noise, which obviously I didn't hear, and is supposed to be quite supernatural.
And you are still alive.
I am still alive.
You promised me.
If the banshee combs her hair, what? And if you say a banshee, it means that someone you know is going to die.
Wow.
But if the banshee throws the comb at you, you're going to die. That's what they told me. I mean, obviously, we grew up knowing about banshees and things, but these greater, finer details were told at a later stage.
This year, 2014, Halloween falls on a Friday. As usual, all four London Walks ghost walks will take place on Halloween. The rest of the London Walks programme will also continue as normal, and this means that the Rock and Roll London Walk this year falls on Halloween, which gives us an opportunity at the London Walks podcast to look at the more macabre side of the music. The population of London increased fourfold between 1800 and 1900. As the number of living, breathing Londoners up on their hind legs increased, so too did the number of permanent Londoners pile up. A permanent Londoner being someone who is staying here forever, due to the indisposition of being 6 feet under our metropolis. The solution to the problem of permanent Londoners was to plant them miles away, deep in the heart of the English countryside, remote locations such as Highgate. Very much part of the urban sprawl today, but in the 19th century, out of sight, out of mind. The same principle applies in rock and roll. As London became a rock and roll mecca in the 60s and 70s, along with our successes and landmarks in music, it followed that London also saw more than its fair share of rock and roll casualties. Given the, lifestyle choices of our heroes, this should come as no surprise. 1967, the summer of love, bells and flowers, incense and all you need is love. Scott McKenzie topped the charts the world over with a groovy bucket list of things to do in San Francisco. And that city by the bay may have seemed all the more appealing in light of the deeply ungroovy rock and roll carnage here in the Big Smoke. London, as ever, marched to the beat of its own drum. And back in 67, the rhythm was that of gunshots, hammer blows, and the rattle of pills. In Belgravia, Brian Epstein, the manager of the Beatles, died of an overdose on the 27th of August, 1967. Just a few weeks earlier, in then frumpy Islington, the playwright Joe Orton, who had written a rejected screenplay for the Beatles called Up Against It, had been bludgeoned to death by his lover, Kenneth Halliwell. Both Epstein and Orton were cremated at Golders Green Crematorium. Orton to the strains of the Beatles and A Day in the Life. A couple of short bus rides from Golders Green, way up in North London, you will find the Holloway Road. It links leafy and blameless suburbia with the wicked city of London. It lies only some 4.5 miles from Charing Cross, but light years away from the swinging London of popular imagination. Grimy in Dayglow 1967, it remains one of London's unloveliest thoroughfares to this day. In relation to swinging London, it must have seemed as remote as had Highgate Cemetery from St Paul's Cathedral in the 1830s. Yet, at number 304 Holloway Road, is a rock and roll shrine like no other in London. A British rock and roll legend with a macabre twist. Joe Meek was an independent record producer and a creative maverick. In both fields, he was the first true pioneer of British rock and roll. Born in the unlikely surroundings of Gloucestershire in 1929, he set up his own studio in his small rented flat at 304 Holloway Road. Ingenious techniques, special effects, and a thoroughly Heath Robinson sensibility mark his work. Vocals recorded in the bathroom, guitars on the stairs, drums muffled with sofa cushions, unorthodox instruments such as ashtrays, combs, and bathtubs, all employed to create his legendary sound. He blazed a trail, particularly in the field of electronica, to the top of the US charts with his Telstar in 1962, recorded by the Tornadoes, the first British group to have a US number one. His Johnny Remember Me is a classic in that most mawkish of rock and roll subgenres, the death song, the deadly medley of late 50s and early 60s hits, including such tracks as the plane crash classic Ebony Eyes and the torrid Tell Laura I Love Her.
I hear the voice of my darling, the girl I love and lost a year ago.
Listening today to Johnny Remember Me, it's hard to believe that this tempestuous slice of histrionic pop was recorded in what was little more than a room and kitchen on the Holloway Road. We can also bring that great London eccentric screaming Lord Sutch into our picture. The late Lord Sutch was the leader of the Monster Raving Loony Party and stood for election to that other chamber of horrors, monsters and crooks, the British Parliament at Westminster. He stood on more than 40 occasions. He was unsuccessful at each and every attempt. In the 1960s, with his group the Savages, Sutch lobbied for pop singles chart hits with only slightly more success. He is regarded today as a cult legend. His 1963 opus on the Decca label, Jack the Ripper, was recorded by Joe Meek at 304 Holloway Road.
Of London late at night.
The Ripper, Jack the Ripper,
with a little black bag that's oh so tight. The Ripper.
Meek had a lifelong interest in the occult. Legend has it that he'd set up tape recorders in graveyards to capture messages from the other side. He also claimed to be able to communicate with his dead hero, Buddy Holly, and regularly received messages from the great Texan rocker from beyond the grave. His early 60s collaborator, lyricist Jeff Goddard, also claimed to have psychic powers. A colourful tale, even by the standards of a branch of show business renowned for its eccentrics. By 1967, however, the hits had dried up. An unpredictable and volatile character at the best of times, Meek was at the time embroiled in a plagiarism lawsuit, which meant that he received not a single penny in royalties from his worldwide hit Telstar. As a gay man in the 1960s, before the decriminalisation of homosexuality, he lived in dread of criminal prosecution and was the subject of numerous blackmail attempts. There was, however, one front page headline left in this most singular of British rock and roll stories. Early in 1967, Meek murdered his landlady, Violet Shenton, in his Holloway Road flat with a single-barreled shotgun before, in that most chilling of journalistic clichés, turning the gun on himself. It was the 3rd of February, 1967. The 8th anniversary of the death of Buddy Holly.
The London Walks podcast was compiled, produced and presented by Andy Hallett and Adam Scott Goulding. For details of the full programme of London Walks, London's best guided walking tours, go to www.walks.com. The London Walks podcast was an APB production.